Today, Hadley Freeman on the years spent investigating her family's secret history. And lots of us love almond milk, but do you know how it's made? I remember as her looking at me all the time, like she wanted something from me. And what I remember is her often chasing me around her apartment with the very incorrectly named gentle comb to brush my hair.
The gentle comb.
Which was a massive misnomer. What she wanted was for me to love her in this very demonstrative way, because truth is she was a little bit lonely. She was just slightly sad, to be honest. And I was a very spoiled, sheltered child, and never occurred to me that adults could be sad, that adults had needs and inner lives of their own. From my perspective, adults were there just to serve me.
Growing up in New York, Guardian writer Hadley Freeman had a difficult relationship with her grandmother. Sala had come to America from Paris during the war, and Hadley remembers that she always seemed unhappy. But as a child, Hadley never understood why.
When I was 5 years old, my parents took me and my sister to Europe for the first time. We flew to Paris and then we got a train to Deauville, which is this seaside town in Normandy in northern France, who is there where my grandmother's two surviving brothers, Henri and Alex, and Henri's wife, Sonia. And so it was just this bunch of really old French people, which was a bit of a disappointment to me. And we were all sort of standing in the dining room waiting for my grandmother to appear. And then I suddenly noticed her standing, watching us, and she was crying. And then she turned around and ran out of the dining room.
That moment in France never left Hadley's mind. As she grew up, she found herself thinking more and more about what had happened to Sala, and why she'd seemed so troubled while the rest of her family and her brothers were not. It wasn't until 2006 that Hadley began to get answers, found in a shoebox at the back of a wardrobe. This chance discovery began an 18-year journey, which took her across Europe and led to her uncovering the incredible story of the Glass family, of Sala and her three brothers, Jacques, Henri and Alex. Now their lives have become a best-selling book. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, Hadley Freeman's search to uncover her family secrets.
All I knew about my grandmother was that she was French, and she was very emphatically French. She dressed French, she talked in this very French way, always saying, oh, la, 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 oui, 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 oui. You know, she would tell me and my sister to call her grand-mère. The only food I ever saw her eating really was a croissant, which she would sort of nibble on a little bit in the morning, and then she wouldn't eat the rest of the day, as far as I could tell. And so I knew that she had been in France and that she came to America to escape what's described to me as the war, and that was pretty much all I knew.
To Hadley, her grandmother seemed very out of place in her home in Miami. The rest of her family still lived in France, while she was married to an American called Bill, who Hadley remembers fondly as being loud and always making jokes. He would play with her and her sister by the pool, while Sala would sit alone reading French fashion magazines under an umbrella.
She was incredibly beautiful, and she had this really beautiful figure, which sounds like a strange thing to say about a grandmother, but she really was. She had this very trim, curvy figure that she would dress in this incredibly stylish way that showed herself off. She'd have these like nipped-in waists on her trousers, these beautiful silk blouses. She would dress in these very French styles, like little Chanel-esque jackets, wow. Yves Saint Laurent-esque trousers, in a way that you don't really see Jewish grandmothers in Miami dressing.
The memory of Sala's clothes and style stayed with Hadley, and she found herself thinking about them again when she began her career as a fashion journalist.
I'd never really been into clothes, and part of that is because I had been anorexic as a teenager, and clothes for me were just about covering up my body. And then I was at university, and suddenly I remember sitting at the breakfast table, or, you know, the table at my parents' house, and reading The Guardian, and there was a feature by Susanna Frankel, who was the fashion editor back then, and just saying to my mom, it'd be kind of fun writing fashion, wouldn't it? And she was like, okay, sure, crazy
not that
daughter,
impressed.
Okay. Yeah. No, you're just like, you know, you've been wearing black skirts from Camden Market for the past 5 years. Like, what are you talking about? You're going to write about fashion. You like looked like you've been rolling in a laundry basket throughout your teen years. But incredibly, The Guardian did give me a chance, so I was on the fashion desk. And so I thought, okay, maybe I'll write about my grandmother's relationship with fashion.
Hadley had been trying to find a way to write about her grandmother for some time, but it always felt painful, and she found herself regretting that she'd never been able to talk to her about her life.
I mean, I wish I'd had the emotional maturity to do so. Instead, I just kept running away from her. Then maybe when I was starting to get old enough to think about it, I was in my mid-teens, and that's when she had a massive stroke, and at which point there was no point talking to her because she actually couldn't talk anymore. So my grandmother died in 1994 when I was 16, and there was never any question about whether I'd go or not. I was never going to go to her funeral. And then Alex died, and then I couldn't stop thinking about them. And that's when I thought, well, maybe I should actually write something.
Hadley began by contacting her uncle and Sala's youngest son. He still lived in Sala's apartment and had kept all of her belongings, including her clothes.
I flew to Miami to my grandmother's little apartment, and I was going through her closet, and then I saw this little red shoebox at the back. I opened it up, and there were all these photo albums and keepsakes and prison plates and photos from clearly concentration camps, and then this little drawing by Picasso at the bottom.
I mean, it's really not something you come across every day in the back of a wardrobe, is it?
It wasn't even that I thought, oh my God, I found a Picasso. It was more just like, oh, okay, this is the one thing in the box that I understand, because obviously this came from Alex, because he was friends with Picasso.
Hadley may have known that Sala's brother Alex had moved in elite circles in Paris, but what she found in the rest of the box came as a surprise to her.
There was a photo album of photos of Sala, Henri, and Alex in the 1920s and 30s. And in a couple of photos, my grandmother is sort of arm in arm with this man, and she just sort of scraped his face out with her thumbnail. So you just have this kind of faceless ghost of a man that she's standing with. There was this metal plate that said Prisoner Glass 1940 on it, which was obviously a war prisoner plate. There are these two photos of this man with glasses who I'd never seen before, and photos of him with a bunch of other guys in what looked very much like a concentration camp. And that's when I thought, oh, crikey, I bet this looks like a proper project. I guess I better stop dicking around.
What Hadley had discovered were clues to lives lived by her grandmother and her brothers that had been hidden for decades. She knew she couldn't ignore them and began trying to piece together what had happened to the Glass family. The problem was, she didn't know where to start.
My best friend Carol Miller would come over to my flat where I was living at the time, and she very handily was working then as a producer for Who Do You Think You Are? And she showed me how I could research some of this stuff. So she showed me, for example, how to access the passenger lists of the boats in the 1930s. And so then I started getting into the archives, going to America, getting, you know, records there. I mean, I was very insecure starting out on this. I really felt I had to educate myself.
As you began uncovering these clues, what did you find out about your family?
Well, the first thing I found out is that my grandmother was as French as I am English, which is to say, not very. She moved to Paris when she was about 14 years old, which completely amazed me because she just seemed so completely, utterly French to me. But in fact, they were all born in this little town called Czarnów, which was then in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was now Poland. And it was 18 kilometers away from a town known as Oswiecim, or more popularly known as Auschwitz, which was 55% Jewish, had Jewish mayors, and they had nice relations with their Catholic Polish neighbors. But then World War I started and their father went off to war and their lives just became horrific. Poland was very brutalized. It was very poor at the end of the war and they wanted someone to blame for their poverty. And so they turned to the Jews. So there was this huge rise of anti-Semitism. Pogroms started in Poland, non-Jews coming into a Jewish town and trashing it and killing Jews, trashing Jewish businesses, stealing Jewish money. So there was this pogrom in November 1918 in Czarnów, and Sala and her three brothers and her mother hid under the bed in the house, and they could hear all this screaming outside. Alex was 12 then, and he thought, well, I'm not just going to lie here and listen to this. And he went outside to decide to fight for his family in the town. And he saw these people coming in, and you know, he looked at their faces and they were sort of deranged with anger. And then he looked closer and he realized he knew them. They were teachers. They were people he knew from the marketplace. That was the point at which his childhood ended.
This was the moment that changed the lives of the Glass children forever. Fearing for their safety in Poland, Jacques, Henri, Alex, Sala, and their mother fled to Paris.
So they arrived in France, and France at this time was very grateful for these Eastern European immigrants. It had lost so many men in World War I. They needed men in the workplace. And it reduced the number of years that these immigrants needed to live in France to be naturalized in order to rush them into the workplace. But the Glasses didn't naturalize. They were unnaturalized immigrants living in France, but loving it. And they changed their names to Henri, Jacques, Alex, and Sarah.
To the siblings, Paris seems safe. But the outbreak of World War II in 1939 brought this chapter of their lives to an abrupt end. Hadley discovered that her family had been ripped apart by the conflict, and as she combed through archives around the world, she began to piece together what had happened to them, starting with the eldest brother, Henri.
Henri was very desperate to be accepted as a Frenchman. And I was really lucky with Henri in terms of researching him because he'd always been very quiet and very private. And I really worried when I was writing this that he was going to be this lacuna in the book. And pretty early on, I went around to see his daughter, Danielle. And I just said to her, you know, did your dad leave anything behind when he died? Maybe like a diary, fingers crossed. She took me down to the basement. There were these four massive suitcases in which every part of his life was filed and detailed. And he kept detailed notes about what he was doing on an almost like week to week basis throughout his whole life, because he never trusted France again after the war. And he always thought he was going to be called to account to explain what he was doing. When the Jews were told to register in 1940, he thought about it and agonized about it and then decided not to. He thought this wasn't a safe idea. And instead, he hid in Paris throughout the war. And Henri had been this brilliant engineer at university, and he invented a machine that essentially brought microfilming to France, and he could shrink documents down so they were really tiny and no one could decipher them. During the war, he would travel around France undercover, microfilming local towns and people's personal records, so their bank details, for example, and essentially saving them. And it was thanks to him that various ports around France were able to be rebuilt after they'd been destroyed during the war. He was able to save loads of towns in money. And so he spent a lot of time, for example, in this one town, Valenciennes, microfilming all the records just opposite the Gestapo's headquarters.
But it sounds like such a terrifying time, doesn't it?
Terrifying and hungry. There was no food anywhere. You know, there were Nazis everywhere. It was unbelievable. After the war, Henri kept doing his microfilm business. It was called Fotasia, and he ran it with this other man. And eventually in the 60s, Henri sold it. The man had died. So Henri and the widow sold it, and they made like millions and millions. And Henri was suddenly this multi-millionaire, like wealthy beyond even today's imagining, really.
While Henri managed against the odds to survive the war, Hadley's research told her that the same was not true of Sala's second brother, Jacques.
So he was a very gentle, sweet, and in many ways passive man. He did what he was told, whether it was his brothers telling him or eventually then what his wife, Mila, would tell him. And he did register as a Jew. He believed that if you followed the rules, then no one would hurt you. And then he was summoned to the very first roundup of Jews. Roundup of the green tickets is what they called it, because all these people were given a green ticket. They were all put on a bus and shipped out to train station and put on a train, and Jacques went to Pithiviers. At one point, his wife, who wasn't shipped out yet, Mila, was back in Paris. She gave birth to their daughter. And Jacques, very, very unusually, was allowed out for a two-day leave to meet his daughter. I went to see this one archive that's just devoted basically to concentration camps in France, and they said they'd never heard of this before, that he'd be allowed out. And I think it's because he was such a gentle, rule-abiding man, the guards trusted him to come back. And they said to him before he left, if you don't come back, we're going to kill all your friends here. And he got to the hospital where Mila was with their baby daughter, Lily. And his brothers were there, Henri and Alex, and they said to him, you know, you've got to run, we will help hide you. And what he decided then determined his fate. He went back at the absolute worst time, when France was really now stepping up the arrests, and he was sent out to Auschwitz. The irony of his life is so bizarre. I mean, he was basically sent home. So he was then killed 3 months after he arrived in October, and they put it down to heart trouble, which seems euphemistic. And his wife and siblings didn't find out until long after the war ended.
What was it like for you researching this part of the family story, going to Auschwitz and reading about this time?
I mean, it's quite grim. And you sort of ask yourself, why am I doing this to myself? I could be writing like a funny book about the day in the life of my dog or something. But but it was something in me that really needed to do this. And Auschwitz was the last research trip I did with my dad. And Auschwitz is pretty grim, but it's also incredibly weird because it is subject to historical changes, historical interpretations, as everything is. So if you go to Auschwitz now, you get a really strong impression that the Polish suffering there is, you know, on a parity with the Jewish suffering. There's so many signs about the numbers of Poles who were killed there. If you do the tour, you don't even really see the gas chambers so much. You just see the wall where the Poles were shot, because I think it was 70,000 Poles were killed at Auschwitz, which is a huge number of people, obviously. But over 1 million Jews were killed. Poland really wants to emphasize that it was not culpable for the concentration camps. But the truth is, Poland was a deeply anti-Semitic country. It's why my grandmother had to leave in the first place, because of the pogroms. And a lot of Poles behaved absolutely abominably during the war and pointed out the Jews to the Germans. And it was disproportionately the Jews who suffered at Auschwitz. And you don't really get that impression when you do the Auschwitz tours these days.
Hadley's search led to her eventually finding a memoir written by the brother she always thought she had known best, Alex.
Alex was this extremely charismatic character who could speak English. He was just this little old French guy when I knew him. He's about 5'2", bald, really tough, always talking about people he'd fought against and who he'd won and who was a traitor in the war and who was a collaborationist. So Alex went down to the south of France and was kind of living a pretty okay life down there. But he was an argumentative person, and he managed to attract enough attention to himself that he got arrested 3 times. And on the 3rd time, he couldn't talk his way out of it. He was tortured and then put on the train to Drancy. And he's on this train, and he just happened to look at the ceiling, and he saw this hole in the ceiling just from rotten wood. And Alex was a very short man. He was about 5'2", and he got his friend, this man called Jacques Schwab Héricourt, to lift him up. And Alex punched the ceiling and sort of knocked out some more of the wood. And then Jacques Schwab Héricourt just pushed him out of the train. I mean, Alex nearly killed escaping from the train. I mean, the train is traveling about 100 kilometers an hour, And he'd had cracked ribs. He writes in his memoir about how his forehead was so ripped up, it was kind of flapped in front of his eyes like a veil. And he would have died there, except some railway workers came and found him. And the railway workers were largely communists. And they hid him by hiding him in a pile of manure, because they knew the Nazis were so vain about their uniforms, they wouldn't look in the pile of manure. He did survive the war, and he went back to Paris, and he worked as a couturier for a while, and then he switched to art, and he became this enormously successful art gallerist and became a very close friend of Picasso. And he just led this incredibly glamorous, fabulous life, hanging out with Dior, Picasso, Edith Piaf, you know, like lots of people who were all in his circle. And yet he was so close, you know, to death. And also, he came from nothing. I mean, his story is really quite amazing.
The one family member who was absent from all of these stories was the woman who had inspired Hadley to begin this journey in the first place, her grandmother.
My grandmother just went to America in 1937, so the only records about her are she's on the passenger list, she got married, she's in America. That's it.
Hadley had never understood why Sala had moved to America while her brothers stayed behind in Paris, a city that she seemed to love so much.
So she was living the life of her dreams in Paris. She had this job she loved, this fiancé she adored. And then in 1937, it all just ended in one night. And what happened was, she was living with her mother at the time, and Alex came around for dinner, and he brought this American man. My grandmother didn't think much about it. They were all having dinner, and suddenly halfway through the dinner, this American man says to her, "You are the most beautiful woman in the world. I love you. Be my wife. Come with me to America."
And he never met her before.
He never met her before. And my grandmother was like, "Oh, this tacky American, it's so embarrassing." And he left, but he kept trying. He was there for a few more days. And Alex said to her, "You have to take this. I know the Nazis are coming. I can see France already turning against my friends in the art world. He's this great guy. I've known him for years. He's a millionaire. He's a fashion designer. He lives on Park Avenue in Manhattan. What more do you want?" So my grandmother, incredibly reluctantly, went to America in 1937 to marry this guy. And she arrives and she realizes not only does this guy not really know Alex, they just basically happen to meet on the street that day. He's not a millionaire. He's not a fashion designer. He doesn't even live in New York. He's this gas station owner who lives in Long Island. And she's now stuck with him.
Her grandmother's sadness slowly began to make sense. Moving to America had never felt like a choice, but a wrench. Forced to leave her home, her family, and her fiancé, who became nothing more than a figure in photographs, his face scratched away by a fingernail.
She was in this tiny Long Island town. There was loads of anti-Semitism still there. The Ku Klux Klan was still very prevalent there. She was with my grandfather's family. They were just very small town people who just wanted to hang out on the porch and gossip. And this was the last thing my grandmother wanted to do. She had very intellectual aspirations. She loved, you know, going to the museums and seeing the art. She did not just want to sit around this tiny Long Island town. And yet that's where she was. And she was expected to make my grandfather's meals twice a day. And that's what her life then was. She was suddenly a Long Island housewife.
But this is what she had had to do to survive.
Well, yes, except on some level, she must have looked back at her brothers. So, okay, one died during the war, yes, but two survived. And they went on to live incredible lives. You know, was this what she'd had to do to survive? I mean, we'll never know.
By the end of the war, Sala had two sons, and she realized she could never go back to Paris. She decided she might be able to return after Bill died. But by the time that happened, it was too late.
So my grandfather died in 1992, and my grandmother had waited all her life for my grandfather to die. And then just as he started to get sick, she had this massive stroke, which meant she was confined to a wheelchair and she couldn't actually speak and she could only move one arm. It was sort of hideous whole situation. And my father and my uncle took her to my grandfather's funeral, and she was just sat in this wheelchair, just crying. And all the people in the funeral were saying, oh, look, isn't that touching? She's so, you know, sad about her husband of 60 years dying, 55 years dying. And she wasn't sad about that. She was sad that this day she'd waited for had come and it didn't matter anymore because she wasn't going anywhere.
Do you think there were elements in her life in America that did make it worth living for her?
So obviously she loved her children very much and she made a life for herself. You know, she had friends, you know, she would go to like bridge clubs and stuff like that, but it was not the life she expected. It was not the life she planned. But hers is a very female story. And I mean, hers is the kind of story that doesn't get told. We're, you know, we're told stories of, you know, masculine adventure and armies and fighting and military triumphs and capture and all that kind of stuff that her brothers went through. The only tool available to her was marriage. And it's not a very, you know, dramatic story. It's not, except emotionally, it's not a story that you can really tell with use of archives. It's an entirely interior, slightly sad story, really.
But it is one that kind of illustrates to us, I think, in a really interesting way about what we value in life and what does make it worth living.
Yes. And also, I think it's a story that is so common among so many women, up to, you know, including this generation in some ways. You know, it's all about female erasure. You're just expected to do this. Whereas her brothers got awards and, you know, medals and everything for what they did.
And that helped you to understand better why, as a child, you'd known her to be quite a sad person.
Sad and also feeling out of place and also needing to justify to herself what she did. So, you know, she wanted us to give her, to be demonstrative in our love, because in some way that would justify what she'd had to give up. And I was too young to understand that, so I didn't.
You've been working on this story for years now,
so
Hadley.
So long.
How have you felt during that time?
Well, it's a huge relief for it to be done. I'm thrilled that people seem to be liking it. I really thought everyone would just think I was an absolute nutcase for having spent two decades on this story about my grandmother. It was 18 years research and 18 months writing. And I'm glad I did it because, you know, I just feel like all of these people's lives are triumphant in different ways. And I'm glad that in some way I've given them a tiny bit of immortality.
And what impact do you think it's had on you?
Well, it's definitely made me more aware of my Jewish background in some ways, and also much more aware of anti-Semitism. I was writing this during the whole anti-Semitism and labor scandal, and now it's being published as the Tory party is closing borders to immigrants. And the immigrants it's closing borders to are exactly the kind of immigrants that my grandmother and her brothers were when they were escaping Poland to Paris. So it's really weird having these kind of echoes of history around you. And you just realize how fragile this stuff is, how easily the machinery can come undone again. And especially because it seemed to be exactly 100 years since the last time we went through this kind of stuff. And yet when you bring this up, people always say, well, what about the right? And you think, well, I already knew about the right. I already knew the right wing was kind of awful on immigrants. What was upsetting was seeing this on the left. But now, as I say, we see the right being so horrific about what they call unskilled immigrants, which, you know, would have blocked out my family from escaping Poland.
Hadley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hadley's book, House of Glass, is out now. Coming up, the hidden cost of making almond milk. Now, many of us are choosing to drink dairy-free milks. Perhaps you like a bit of oat milk in your coffee or soy on your cereal. Almond milk was the preferred choice for journalist Annette McGivney until she visited California's Central Valley, which produces 80% of the world's almond supply.
If you're looking for an ethical plant milk, you might think almond milk is the best bet, but there's a dark side. 3 billion commercial honeybees die every year in the United States pollinating almonds. Every year at this time, 70% of all the commercial honeybees in the United States are shipped to California's Central Valley, where the almond industry grows their trees. They extend for miles and miles, a size bigger than the state of Delaware. They are so beyond what could be considered natural farming. Bees are expected to perform their pollination duties over and over. Researchers have not been able yet to directly connect the death of honeybees to the almond industry, but it's clear there are a lot of indirect causes. First up is pesticides. The almond industry uses more pesticides in terms of sheer quantity than any other crop grown in the United States. These pesticides can seriously harm the bees, even if it comes a year later where they are suffering long-term damage. Then there's the stress of transport. Having the bees travel such long distances exposes them to diseases and parasites. Lastly, beekeepers are having to do things to keep the bees alive in the short term that weakens them in the long term. And that is all due to meet the destructive demands of the almond industry. I spoke to a beekeeper named Dennis Arp, who started making honey with his bees more than 30 years ago. Dennis had to pull back from honey because cheap Chinese imports were undercutting his profits. So then he looked to the almond industry and commercial pollinization to keep his business going. Within a decade, 30 to 40% of his bees were being lost in the almond industry. It was like training troops for war. He knew a lot of them wouldn't be coming back from the almond groves. Dennis became caught in this cycle where he was drawing the revenues from the almond industry, but then he had to take those revenues and put them right back into trying to keep his bees alive. Obviously, this is not sustainable. Unless the almond industry comes up with a way to allow their agricultural model to become more sustainable, there's a real chance that commercial honeybees might not be able to survive, and then we'll lose our pollinators, which are producing not just almonds, but 1/3 of everything that we eat.
was Annette McGivney. Thanks to her and Hadley Freeman. Today's episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.